From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Doors' 40th anniversary celebration begins next month. On today's Fresh Air, Doors' keyboard player Ray Manzarek joins us at the piano, and we hear from Doors' drummer John Densmore.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
The Doors, coming up on Fresh Air. First the news.
Support for NPR comes from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yeah, come on.
Our executive producer, Danny Miller, has told me he thinks one of the smartest moves I ever made was convincing Ray Manzarek of The Doors, who played all those now classic organ solos, to do our interview at the piano. With The Doors' year-long 40th anniversary celebration about to begin, what a perfect opportunity to listen back to Manzarek. The mythology surrounding The Doors has mostly centered around its lead singer, Jim Morrison, who died under mysterious circumstances in 1971 and is still considered one of rock's tortured poets and sex gods. But instrumentally, The Doors' distinctive sound was based on Manzarek's keyboard playing.
When the music's over, when the music's over here, when the music's over, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, turn up the lights. Yeah, yeah.
I spoke with Ray Manzarek in 1998. After the publication of his book about The Doors, he told me he met Morrison in film school at UCLA, but they didn't think of forming a band until they got out of school.
Biblically, 40 days and 40 nights after we said our goodbyes after graduation, I'm sitting on the beach wondering what I'm going to do with myself. Who comes walking down the beach but James Douglas Morrison? Looking great, lost 30 pounds. Was down to about 135, 6 feet tall, Leonardo, Michelangelo's David. He had the ringlets and curly hair starting to kind of fall over his ears and gentle locks. And I thought, God, he looks just great. And I said, Jim, come on over here, man. Come on. It's Ray. Hey, come on. And he said, Ray, oh, man, good to see you. And, you know, we did, hey, buddy, hey, pal, you know, high five and all that kind of stuff that guys do. And I said, well, what have you been up to? He said, well, I decided to stay here in Los Angeles. I said, well, good, man, cool. Tell me, what's going on? And he said, well, I've been living up on Dennis Jacobs' rooftop, consuming a bit of LSD, and writing songs. And I said, whoa, writing songs. Okay, man, cool. Like, sing me a song. You know, and he said, oh, I'm kind of shy. Because I knew he was a poet. He knew I was a musician. He said, sing me a song. So he sat down on the beach, dug his hands into the sand, and the sand started streaming out in little rivulets, and he kind of closed his eyes, and he began to sing in a Chet Baker haunted whisper kind of voice. He began to sing Moonlight Drive, and when I heard that first stanza, let's swim to the moon, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide, I thought, ooh, spooky and cool, man. I can do all kinds of stuff behind that. I could do kind of... sort of like, let's swim to the moon, you know, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. And I thought, ooh, I can put all jazz chords and I can put some kind of bluesy stuff. I thought, yeah. I could do my Ray Charles and my Muddy Waters, Otis Spann influences, and I could do just all kinds of bluesy, funky stuff behind what Jim was singing. And then he had a couple of other songs, My Eyes Have Seen You and Summer's Almost Gone, and they were just, they had beautiful melodies to them that would just allow for chord changes and improvisations. And I said, man, this is incredible. let's get a rock and roll band together. And he said, that's exactly what I want to do. And I said, all right, man. But one thing, what do we call the band? It's got no name. We can't call it Morrison and Manzarek. I mean, or Eminem, or, you know, two guys from Venice Beach or something. He said, no, man, we're going to call it The Doors. And I said, that's ridiculous. The Door. Oh, wait a minute. You mean like the doors of perception, the doors in your mind? And the light bulb went on, and I said, that's it, the doors of perception. He said, no, just the doors. I said, like Aldous Huxley. He said, yeah, but we're just the doors. And that was it. We were the doors. And that's how the band got formed.
So when you and Jim Morrison decided to create a band that left the lead singer and keyboard player, you still needed other musicians.
Yep.
So you ended up finding the drummer, John Densmore, and guitarist, Robbie Krieger. But you became not only the keyboard player, but the bass player, too.
It was of necessity.
Tell us that story.
We had the four of us. I found John and Robbie in the Maharishi's meditation. And kind of an Eastern mysticism. We were into the same thing, the yoga, same kind of yoga that the Beatles were into. And that came out of the song This Is the End, comes out of that. So we were all seekers after spiritual enlightenment, and so was Jim, of course. But we didn't have a bass player, so I applied my boogie-woogie background, my rock and roll boogie-woogie, because when I discovered boogie-woogie, that was the whole thing. And you just keep that left hand going. You don't do anything with it. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. And the right hand does the improvisations. So I had done that over and over and over as a kid, so it was very easy for me to, once we found the Fender Rhodes keyboard bass, 32 notes of extra low-sounding low notes, it was very easy for me to do. So that's what I did on the piano bass. Or like Riders on the Storm. And that's what I did. I just over and over, repetitive bass lines that are just like Boogie Woogie. It just keeps on going. And it becomes hypnotic. And that was that's why Lefty here is thank you. He did a very good job. He's not too quick. He's a bit of a slow-witted fellow, Lefty, but he's really strong and solid and plays what he has to play. So Lefty became our bass player.
So your left hand and right hand were playing separate keyboards.
Oh, of course, yeah. One was I had a Fender Rhodes the Fender keyboard bass sitting on top of a Vox Continental organ, and the Vox Continental organ was what I played with my right hand, and the Fender keyboard bass with my left hand.
Love me one time, could not speak. Love me one time, baby. Yeah, my knees got weak. Love me two times, girl. Last week, all through the week. Love me two times.
That's The Doors, Love Me Two Times. We're listening to a 1998 interview with Ray Manzarek, who is the band's keyboard player. The Doors' history is filled with stories about the unpredictable behavior of lead singer Jim Morrison. One of those stories is about what happened during the Light My Fire recording session. The engineer, Bruce Botnick, had brought in a television and put it in the studio. And when Morrison noticed it, he exploded. I'll let Manzarek tell the story.
Bruce Botnick has the Dodgers on. The Dodgers are in the pennant race. Bruce Botnick's a big baseball fan. Sandy Koufax is pitching, the king, the greatest, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. He's recording with the Doors. He brings his portable television set. He wants to see the game. It's the middle of the afternoon. Dodgers are playing, and he's got his television. He couldn't put it in the control room. There's too much electronic equipment, and it just, with the rabbit ears, these are the old days, folks. This is before cable. This is when people had rabbit ears coming off of the television set. He couldn't do it in the control room. Too much electronic equipment, too much static. He found a good place for it off to the side in the studio area, facing the window, the control room window. It wasn't in anybody's way or anything. Everything was fine. So we're in the middle of Light My Fire, and it's solo time. And I'm about to go Coltrane and do my stuff. And Jim comes out of the control room, or out of his vocal booth. You put a singer in a vocal booth. And he starts dancing around. He's having a great time. Then he comes over to the TV set, and he sees the TV set. Then he looks around and notices that it's on. He freaks out. It's like, what is a TV set on in the recording studio? We're making Doors music here for the first time. This is our first recording session. First time in our lives. We're in the studio. We're doing Light My Fire. And a baseball game is on the TV set. Jim picks up the TV set, unplugs the damn thing, and hurls it at the control room window. We freaked, man. Everybody just, we're in the middle of, I'm just going to town, and all of a sudden it was like, Jim, whoa, no, God, don't throw it at the dwing. Hits the control room window. Thank God the control room window is double thick glass. Bounces off the control room window, falls on the floor, and shatters in 500 pieces. And that was the end of the session. And Bruce Botnick comes running out. He says, Jim, what have you done? And Jim said, what's this TV set doing here, Bruce? I was watching the baseball game. That's my TV set. And Jim said, no TV sets in the recording studio ever.
You also write in your memoir, Light My Fire, about you know, Jim Morrison's period is like a sexual god. And you write about how, like, he'd wear his leather pants with no underwear so the contours of his manhood can be
yes.
could be seen under the leather. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to kind of be at the epicenter of this kind of like sexual adoration.
Oh, it was fabulous. It was fabulous. I mean, we made our music. That's what we did. You know, the fact that Jim attracted the little girls was something that I knew he was going to do when I saw him at 135 pounds on the beach. We're going to start a rock and roll band, and you're about the handsomest guy I've seen. I didn't say this to him. The girls are going to love this guy. And the girls did love him.
We're listening back to a 1998 interview with Ray Manzarek, who is the Doors keyboard player. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air has been a national program since 1987, and in that time, we've created an archive of interviews with some pretty incredible people, like Ray Manzarek. We really enjoy playing back some of those interviews for you. Thank you for supporting Fresh Air over the years and enabling us to produce the show and create this archive. Today, we come to you again and ask you to support Fresh Air and all the programs you enjoy by making a pledge to your station. Thank you. Ray Manzarek just told us some stories about Jim Morrison's destructive behavior. So how did the head of the record company feel about that? We're about to hear the answer from Jack Holtzman, the founder of the Doors record company, Elektra Records. I spoke with Holtzman in 1998 after the publication of his book about Elektra called Follow the Music. Elektra started out as a folk and ethnic music label and first made its mark with such performers as Gene Ritchie, Theodore Bickel, Judy Collins, Tom Paxton, and Phil Oakes. Elektra's first big hit was The Doors' single Light My Fire. What attracted a folk and classical music fan like Jack Holtzman to The Doors? Well, one thing was Whiskey Bar, The Doors' version of a Brecht Weil song.
Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Oh, moon of Alabama, now must say
I asked Jack Holtzman about the difficulties he faced working with Jim Morrison, who was talented, commercially successful, but often out of control.
From our standpoint, the difficulties in Jim's life and the way he expressed them were nothing as compared to the magic of the recordings. It was more than Light My Fire. The first Doors album was as close to a perfect album as I've ever been involved with. That album really pushed the envelope, and I was just so thrilled to be associated with it. And if there was a price to pay, that was okay with me. I had dealt with some outrageous artists before who had problems, and artists afterwards who had problems. And I found it best to keep my distance because I am the person who runs their record company, and I am the surrogate for the audience. And it's my job to make sure that things keep moving and that the artists are given the very best possible circumstances in which to record. And these are the issues that you have to deal with.
So you try to keep your distance in part so you could remain kind of the authority figure and not get too close with anyone.
Well, it makes it difficult if at some point you have to take a stand on something and you've been hanging out with them all the time. It erodes the special relationship that you have with them. And I think that the Doors appreciated that. I know Jim did. Before he went to Paris, he wanted to have sort of a farewell drinking session with me. Well, I'm smart enough not to have more than two with Jim Morrison because Jim's big enemy was alcohol. And he could be a prince. You could take him anywhere, but pour a few drinks into Jim and he would go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, and it was a real problem. So I would never try to match him drink for drink. But I remember this evening so vividly because we're sitting in this bar and we've each had our second drink, and Jim begins to taunt me, "Jack, you got to go more out on the edge." And I responded, "Jim, it's great being on the edge. The trick is not to bleed." And he sort of paused for a moment, and then we talked about movies.
Now, why did you decide to sign the Doors? What appealed to you about their music?
I went to see another group called Love, who was on Elektra. And Arthur Lee, who was the essential linchpin of that group, said, "Stick around for the other group that's on the bottom of the bill." And I did. And I wasn't really very impressed. But there was something about the group that kept bringing me back, and was only later that I figured out what it was. It was a kind of austerity in their musical line. If I were to compare the Doors to architecture, I would say that they were the Bauhaus of 60s rock and roll. And I think that cleanliness of line and the expressive lyrics and the sheer beautiful simplicity of it is what has made the group last for over 30 years.
When you found out about Jim Morrison's death, what responsibilities did you have? Did you have to take care of his personal effects or anything like that?
No, what I had to take care of first was my own emotion. Jim had been so special to me, and the band was phenomenal. And they had played such a vital and pivotal role in the growth of Elektra. Jim had been kind to me and my family. He would remember my son Adam's birthday and bring him a musical instrument and spend time with him. So I had to deal with that. But I also realized that I had to deal with what I thought was going to be a media circus. And indeed, it had been for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But I was lucky. I had 2 days to prepare. I knew about it on a Monday, and it wasn't public knowledge until Wednesday evening. So I sent my my number two man, Bill Harvey, out to the West Coast. We had press releases prepared. We told the staff at the appropriate time. We had to tell Paul Rothschild, who had been their producer for all of the albums except the final one, L.A. Woman. And we got all of that stuff done. So when the phone call started coming and people wanted the radio interviews, we had determined that we were going to let the Doors do most of the talking, the Doors and Pam, and we would speak only about what their music meant to us and to their fans.
Jack Holtzman founded Elektra Records, which recorded the Doors. We'll hear more from Doors keyboard player Ray Manzarek in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange. When you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A year-long series of events celebrating the Doors' 40th anniversary begins next month. Coming up, Doors drummer John Densmore remembers the night Jim Morrison got naked on stage, and keyboard player Ray Manzarek sits down at the piano to show us how he came up with the opening riff on Light My Fire.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be so limitless and free, desperately in need of some stranger's hand?
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year, at casey.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's Sound About Philly audio walking tours at soundaboutphilly.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're getting a jump on celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Doors' first recording. The official year-long celebration begins next month. The surviving members of the band have a new book coming out next month, and Rhino is bringing out a Doors box set. The band's first album was released in January 1967. A cult developed around its lead singer, Jim Morrison, who wrote lyrics about his obsessions with sex, death, and insanity. He lived a life of excess and died of a heart attack in 1971 at the age of 27. John Densmore was the Doors' drummer. I spoke with him in 1990 after the publication of his memoir, Riders on the Storm.
What were your early shows like when you started to play together as a group?
Well, the first club was the London Fog, a real sleazy place where we kind of were really just honing our stuff, and Jim wouldn't even face the audience. He was so nervous. We had this sort of circle of energy that we developed in rehearsal, and he didn't want to break it. Then we moved on to the Whiskey A Go-Go, became the house band, and we really opened up then, and we played everybody. The Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Van Morrison, Frank Zappa. And as every group came in each week, we'd kind of, well, let's show them how good we are. And then the record people start coming around.
You write that when you started playing music, it wasn't yet cool to be a musician. It was cool to be an athlete, but not a musician. Mm. Then you become a musician, and it's real cool to be a musician. And I'm sure there were always groupies, you know, backstage or trying to get backstage. Were you surprised at quite how cool it became to be a musician?
Yeah, I didn't get it. I thought I was supposed to be a nerd, and now I'm cool. So I'm going to go back to high school now. Because it's cool, isn't it?
I want to ask you about a now very well-known incident that happened during a Doors concert, and I'm thinking of the night that Jim Morrison said, "Let's see a little skin, let's get naked." So what happened after he said that?
He did not expose himself. It's true, Jim was drunk. He was getting into alcohol heavily, and he had just seen Julian Beck and Judith Malina's Living Theater, which was a very confrontational thing where they said, "No passports, no visas, no boundaries," and they walked around the audience in little G-strings. And he was kind of fed up with us having to play the hits, but he was also getting burnt out, unfortunately, from substance abuse. So Miami, he tried to interject confrontational theater into our performance. Didn't tell us, of course. And he stopped songs and said things like that, and things like, "Don't let them shove you around in the S dot 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 of the world." And he took his shirt off and ran around, and he threw a cop's hat in the audience, and the cop threw his hat in the audience, and there's a lot of people on stage, so a security guard flipped him into the audience thinking he was a fan. It was real chaos. But sorry, folks, no exposure, no oral copulation. Jim didn't play an instrument, and he was real enamored with Robbie's guitar picking, as I was. He played flamenco, Robbie did, and it looked like a crab crawling across the strings. So he would get down on his knees and look at that, and hence we have obscenity charges. We paid the police for the hat, and everything was fine. We were laughing, left town for 4 days, and then we get these warrants. I think maybe some kids went home, I don't know, drunk or missing a shirt, and the parents, "What is this? What have you been at?" And, let's call up the politicians. "Oh, let's get reelected. Well, yeah, rock and roll, it's moral decay. Let's get them." And then we have 30,000 people in the Orange Bowl with Anita Bryant and Jackie Gleason rallying for decency. We didn't play that one.
Oh, you didn't play their rally, huh? Now, what did you do on stage when the police came on stage?
Well, I abandoned the stage when I heard it crack on the left side. Oh, and before that, there was a can of Orange Day Glow paint thrown on us. So I jumped off the stage, and I landed on the light board, and the whole thing collapsed.
Did the lights go out when that happened?
Just the stage lights. We're talking chaos, Terry. I remember going upstairs and watching Jim, you know, as I said, he got flipped into the audience, and the kids weren't hurting him or anything, and he started leading this kind of snake dance, and everyone was behind him, and it was wild from above. It looked like a whirlpool.
Now, what effect did these charges of lewd and lascivious behavior have on the band?
Well, it really ruined our live career for a year or so, and our manager said, oh, we've lost $1 million. And I'm thinking, good, I don't care. This is a runaway train here, and Jim's in trouble, and no one's stopping him. Not that he could be stopped, but we're all turning the other cheek or something because of commerce or some rubbish. I don't care, you know. Let's defuse this myth-building insanity a little bit. So that's what I felt.
Were you ever resentful that Morrison got so much more attention than anyone else in the band did?
When we got the artwork for the first album cover, I thought to myself, well, why is his head so big? You know, it covered the whole album, and I'm like in the corner. And then I thought, okay, well, so I guess he'll sell more records. I'll sell copies of Soldier of Fortune, so I'm small. Yeah, you know, but then I see what that bright spotlight does to you, you know, and I'm going, oh, okay, I'm glad I'm kind of just on the fringes here, getting just a little singed.
John Densmore was the drummer for The Doors. Our interview was recorded in 1990. We'll hear more from Doors keyboard player Ray Manzarek after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're getting a jump today on The Doors' 40th anniversary celebration, which officially begins next month. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in 1998 with Doors' keyboard player, Ray Manzarek. He sat at our piano. In your memoir, you write a lot, really, about how The Doors developed their sound and how you developed your sound as the keyboard player with the group. Let's take an example of one of those songs. Why don't we look at Light My Fire, which
sure.
is... probably the most famous or
most
one of the
famous
most famous
Doors song, yeah.
Sure.
The most
yeah.
famous Doors song. You know, it's that worldwide popular appeal, most famous. And Robbie Krieger is actually the writer of Light My Fire. So the way we would work on songs is somebody would bring a song in and then everyone would go to work on it. It would be like little bees just or little things spinning and working and weaving. So Robbie came in with a song. He said, I got a new song called Light My Fire, the first song Robbie Krieger ever wrote. What a genius he is. He's just the greatest guy. Great guitar player and great songwriter. I've got a song called Light My Fire. So he plays the song for us. And it's kind of a Sonny and Cher kind of dun, 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 light my fire. And it's like, okay, good chord change. What are the chord changes there? And he shows me an A minor to an F sharp minor. And that's like, whoa, that's hip. That's cool. And then... and that's when he went into the Sonny and Cher part. No, we're not going to do a Sonny and Cher kind of song here, man. And that was popular at the time. Densmore says, look, we got to do a Latin kind of beat here. Let's do something in kind of a Latin groove. And I'm doing this left-hand line. So John's doing ka-chinka-chinka-dunga. And we set up this Latin groove and then go into a hard rock four. Robbie's only got a one verse. He needs a second verse. And Morrison says, okay, let me think about it for a second. And Jim comes up with the classic line, and our love becomes a funeral pyre. You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I were to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher as Robbie's. And Jim comes, the time to hesitate is through. In other words, seize the moment, seize the spiritual LSD moment. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. Whoa, that's kind of heavy. Try now, we can only lose, meaning the worst thing that can happen to you is death. And our love becomes a funeral pyre. Our love is consumed in the fires of Agni. And it's like, God, Jim, what a great, great verse, man. So we've got verse, chorus, and then it's time for solo. So anyway, the verse goes, time to hit and do that. You know how that goes. You've heard it a million times. And then into the chorus, come on, baby, light my fire. So it's time then for some solos. We've done a verse, chorus. Now what do? We got to play some solos. We got to stretch out. Here's where John Coltrane comes in. Here's where the Doors jazz background. John's a jazz drummer. I'm a jazz piano player. Robbie's a flamenco guitar player. And we all said, you know, we're in A minor. Let's see. What do? Da, 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 da. It ends up on an E. So how about My Favorite Things, John Coltrane. It's My Favorite Things, except Coltrane's doing it in D minor. But the left hand is exactly the same thing. It's in 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. A minor, the Doors, Light My Fire, is in 4. We're going from A minor to B minor. So it's the same thing as and that's how the solo comes about. And then we just go. So it's John Coltrane's My Favorite Things. And Coltrane's Ole Coltrane. And then that's the chord structure. Then I would solo over it. Robbie would solo over it. And at the end of our two solos, we'd go into a 3 against 4. I'm keeping the left hand going exactly as it goes. That hasn't changed. That's the 4. On top of it is 3. And into the turnaround. And we're back at verse 1 and verse 2. Back into our Latin groove. So it's basically a jazz structure. It's verse, chorus, state the theme, take a long solo, come back to stating the theme again. And that's how Light My Fire came about. The only thing left to do was to come up with that little turnaround thing. I hadn't had that yet. And we said, now how do we start the song? Do we just jump on an A minor to an F sharp? We're going to do that, vamp a little bit? I said, no, we need something more. We can't just vamp a little bit. And I started this. I put my Bach back to work, put my Bach hat on, and came up with a circle of fifths. So I started like this. Like a Bach thing, like. So, same kind of thing. B flat, I'm in G, D, F, up to B flat, E flat, A flat, to the A, to A major, yeah, that's it. And then we'll go to the A minor. I'm thinking all this to myself. So that's how the introduction came about. F, B flat, E flat, A flat, A. And the drums and everything. Jim comes in singing. And a Latinesque, and then into hard rock. So that's how Light My Fire goes. That's the creation of Light My Fire.
And you come up with this great organ solo in the middle.
Oh, that was just luck.
Which is, of course, cut out of the single.
Right, exactly.
Because your producer figured we got to get this on the radio.
Right.
So we got to do a singles version,
yeah,
and it was, what, 6 or 7 minute track?
7 minutes. We had to cut down 7 minutes to 2 minutes and under 3 minutes. You know, 2 minutes and 45 seconds, 2:50 would be ideal.
So he calls you into the office, plays you his version,
yeah, well,
his edited
version. Paul Rothschild, a brilliant genius, producer, and Bruce Botnick was our engineer. Those two guys were, door number five, door number six. Without those two guys, there were six doors in the recording studio, the four musicians and Paul Rothschild and Bruce Botnick. Without them, we never would have done nearly what we did. Paul said, I'm gonna make an edit here. I'm going to do some edits. I'm going to cut Light My Fire down from 7 minutes to 2:45, 2:50. And I said, good luck, man. I don't see how you're going to do it. There's solos, Robbie's solo, my solo, all this stuff. I mean, you're going to have to do little, I figured he's going to have to do little bits and cuts and here and there and there, and just little tiny little incisions like, you know, the Chinese torture of 1,000 cuts is what he was going to have to do. You actually had to cut tape in those days, no computers, so you actually cut the tape. 2 days later, Rothschild calls and said, okay, man, I got it. I said, well, you got it. How did you do it so fast? You got 1,000 cuts. And he said, no. Just come on in. I'm not going to tell you what I did, how I did it. I just want you to listen to it. So the song starts. We're all in the control room on the big speakers at Sunset Sound. The song starts with the regular introduction, and then it's into... And it's going along, and then come on, baby, light my fire, and that's going along. Now we're into the second verse. The time to hesitate is through, no time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose, our love becomes a funeral pyre. Everything's going exactly, come on, baby, light my fire. Nothing has changed, everything is exactly the same. Come on, baby, light my fire, try to set the night on fire. Now it's time for the solos. I think, where's the edit, man? And we're into the solos. And I thought, I don't know where he's going to cut. This is insane. And all of a sudden, where I'm supposed to go... You know, play my organ solo. What happens? It goes... It goes to the end of the solos. And it back into the turnaround. And there's like not a solo. There's no solos. I'm out. I've got 3 minutes of solo. Robbie's got 2.5 minutes of solo. It's all gone. It just goes da, 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 and turnaround. And I think, oh no, what's. And then we go back into verse number three. And then we do that exactly as the song is. And then verse number four, it's time to hesitate, no time to wallow in the mire. Trying to be in love becomes a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. And it's the end of the song. And that's it. It's 2 minutes and 45 seconds long, and there are no solos in the entire song. And I thought, I'm going to kill this guy. I looked at Robbie, and Robbie said, you want to kill him? Let's kill him. And Paul said, hold it. Listen, I know the solos aren't there, but just think, you don't know the song. You've never heard the song. You're 17 years old. You're in Poughkeepsie. You're in Des Moines. You're in Missoula, Montana. You've never heard of The Doors. All you know is a 2 minute and 45 second song is going to come on the radio. It's called Light My Fire. Does that work? And we all looked at each other and said, you know what, man? You're right. It does. It works.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through.
Ray Manzarek was recorded in our studio in 1998. Next month, a new book will be published about The Doors, written by the surviving members and Ben Fonctoris. And Rhino Records will release a Doors box set. This is all part of The Doors' 40th anniversary celebration. This is Fresh Air. I know Jim Morrison had, well, more sensual things on his mind when he said, the time to hesitate is through,
But allow me to appropriate that famous line for the occasion at hand, which is a public radio fundraiser. Come on, it's not like you'll get burned giving money for some untried and untested product. You know what public radio is, and you know that your pledge is what's needed to keep it strong. So enough from me, I'll just say thank you. After Clint Eastwood won an Oscar for directing Million Dollar Baby, the 76-year-old screen legend began work on his most ambitious project, two films shot back-to-back that revolve around the bloody Battle of Iwo Jima. The first, Flag of Our Fathers, opened nationwide today. David Edelstein has a review.
Some critics regard Clint Eastwood as an American old master, his direction like a great jazz musician's affectless cool. I find it, with exceptions, a mixture of the limp and the ham-handed. But Flags of Our Fathers is one of those exceptions. The storytelling is clunky as usual, but Eastwood has never directed sequences as fluid and poetic and profoundly disturbing. The movie is adapted from the bestseller by James Bradley with Ron Powers, and it's another elegy to the World War II greatest generation. But there's a critique of the culture built in. At its center is the immortal Joe Rosenthal photograph of five men, their faces obscured, struggling to raise a flag at the top of Mount Suribachi on the Japanese island of Iwo Jima, one of the most inspiring images ever captured. Without discrediting the power of that image, the movie, like the book, goes on to expose its petty genesis and its dispiriting aftermath. The film begins with a voiceover. Harv Presnell, sounding eerily like Bob Dole, asserts, "Every jackass thinks he knows what war is." What follows is a scene so painful that it's hard to wrap one's mind around it. A medic, played by Ryan Phillippe, tries to keep an American soldier's innards from spilling out. Suddenly, a Japanese soldier leaps over a ridge, and the medic grinds his own bayonet into the enemy's stomach. That mirror image nightmare isn't carried through the rest of the film, but everything that follows is suffused by it, and by the irreconcilability of the fact of war with slogans meant to sell bonds. Eastwood's co-producer is Steven Spielberg, and there are similarities between the slaughters on the beach of this Iwo Jima and the Omaha of Saving Private Ryan. But the way that Eastwood backs off from the splattery spectacle strikes me as a mark of decency. The carnage is intense enough to haunt you, but not relentless enough to punish you. Eastwood leaches the color out of the frame, leaving a sickly green, and he's composed a melancholy score that makes even victory seem like loss. We rarely glimpse the tens of thousands of Japanese hidden in tunnels in that mountain, so the bloodshed is disconnected. Eastwood shot another film simultaneously, Letters from Iwo Jima, from the Japanese perspective. In that movie, opening in the near future, he'll take us inside Suribachi. Flags of Our Fathers appears at first to be at cross purposes with itself. It says the men who returned from war were not heroes, and then goes on to show them sacrificing themselves for one another with what seems like superhuman heroism. That's where the photo comes in. The mystery behind that flag planting is carried by its three surviving subjects, played by Phillippe, Jesse Bradford, and Adam Beach, none of whom feels entitled to the adulation they receive on the home front. There's a trace of the right stuff in the depiction of so-called real men who blanch under the efforts of their handlers' marketing. But those astronauts weren't eaten alive by survivor's guilt. And there's another issue here. There were two photos, and one of the soldiers in the famous one, which is actually a recreation, has been misidentified. That weighs most heavily on Beach's Ira Hayes as he listens to his handler, played by John Slattery.
So, we got a hell of a lot of money to raise, not a lot of time. White House tomorrow, Then we trot you over to shake hands with a couple of hundred congressmen who won't pull a penny out of their pockets, politicians and actors. You put them in a restaurant together, they die of old age before picking up the check. Then New York City, Times Square, dinners with various hoi polloi, then Chicago.
Who are these Gold Star mothers?
That's what we're calling the mothers of the dead flag raisers. You present each mother with a flag. They say a few words. People will money. It'll be so moving.
But this is Hank Hansen's mom.
Lovely woman. She knows how close you and her son were. He wrote home about you. She is very, very much looking forward to meeting you.
Hank wasn't in the picture.
Sorry?
Hank didn't raise that flag. He raised the other one, the real flag.
The what? The real flag? There's a real flag?
Yeah, ours was the replacement flag. We put it up and they took the other one down.
Am I the only one getting a headache here? You know about this?
It was after it was already in the papers. The mothers had already been told, Bud.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, why tell me? I'm only the guy that has to explain it to 150 million Americans.
It's when the movie gets into the specifics of the men's guilt that the familiar Eastwood seams show. As Hayes, a Native American whose feelings of inadequacy, reinforced by rampant prejudice against his people, drives him further into drunken disillusionment, Beach emotes in a vacuum. It's the sort of performance that gets nominated for awards because you can't escape the acting. Ryan Phillippe is a study in colorlessness, and many of the soldiers blur together. But the infelicities don't matter, finally. Flags of Our Fathers fits into Eastwood's late-in-life agenda. To make violence, even in self-defense, seem soul-killing, and to expose the gulf between reality and myth. After this, how can we ever again make our peace with the iconography of war?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000, of the hip-hop duo Outkast. He has a new animated series called Class of 3000 on the Cartoon Network. Join us for the next Fresh Air.